Hello, I'm Alistair Humphreys, and Living Adventurously is a podcast in which I get the excuse to chat to people who go about things in an interesting way, typically fueled by enthusiasm and curiosity. And one of my driving selfish motivations for starting this podcast was to get to spend a little time chatting to cool people. And Craig Mod is definitely one of those. I am a big fan. He is a writer, a photographer, a maker of newsletters, and a long-distance walker. He's written a new and beautiful book called Things Become Other Things, and he also really loves Japanese pizza. Now, whilst a normal person would probably be most excited about chatting to Craig about his long adventures through Japan, where he's lived for many years, I've personally always been really fascinated and envious at Craig's ability to grow and build loyal and enthusiastic online audiences through his email newsletters. Now, I appreciate that might not sound very exciting to many of you, but that's what floats my boat these days. Craig, thank you for joining me today. Down from the stratosphere of your globally enormous podcast chats to me in my messy little shed. Welcome. One thing you and I have in common, along with many of my previous podcast guests, is a love of long, difficult, slow, painful, boring, magical, wonderful adventures. So I think a good place to start would be, please could you just give us all a flavour of your big walks in Japan? I don't know, your biggest, your most recent, what you like to do with these walks, why you do it. What, give us a flavour of your adventuring side of life.
Yeah, so I've done, first of all, thanks for having me. Like I said before we started recording, you know, I've been following your adventures for, it feels like at least a decade now too. So it's great. I'm really happy to be here and chatting. I started doing these big walks across parts of Japan. Basically, Japan is crisscrossed with a lot of old roads. It's an old, you know, it's a country with a lot of history, and you know, much like England. Where are you calling? Where are we chatting from? Where are you calling in from?
I'm just outside London, but I actually grew up near your recent big walk through England, which is something I want to chat to you about later.
Cool. Yeah. So like England, Europe has a lot of these big walks, big long, you know, routes, historical routes, pilgrimage routes, things like that. And like in a similar vein, Japan does as well. I kind of say that because people who grew up in the U.S., we aren't really exposed to this in the same way. I mean, there are like obviously the Pacific Coast Trail or the Appalachian Trail, things like that. These giant mega nature walks where you're just kind of like in a tunnel of trees for like 3 months. That's how someone described the Appalachian Trail to me. They said it was like, it's pretty, it sounded pretty ascetic, pretty grueling in a lot of ways, but, also, you know, sort of interesting, very, American in some ways, but you know, where you're carrying everything on your back and you're camping and you're resupplying. But you know, England, all the paths, the Cotswolds, the coast to coast 300K, Wainwright's coast to coast, things like that. These are all, you know, the Santiago de Camino de Santiago in Spain, all these routes kind of have infrastructure, right? Because pilgrims weren't camping and they didn't, you know, they weren't carrying everything on their back. They needed food. So Japan has kind of a history of that as well. And so I've walked Tokyo to Kyoto 3 times. I've done it in, there's 2 main routes and I've done one of the routes both ways and I plan on doing the other one the other way as well. One is called the Tokaido. The other is called the Nakasendo. And I've done a lot of walking on the Kii Peninsula, which is this peninsula south of Osaka, Kyoto. And the Kii Peninsula has the only other UNESCO World Heritage certified walk in the world, pilgrimage walk in the world. So the first one is Santiago in Spain. And then the second one is this Kumano Kodo in the Kii Peninsula. And the Kumano Kodo is actually, it's like this, like almost like a spider web of walks. You know, people kind of think of it as maybe one route. You know, the Camino in Spain is as well. You know, from Santiago, kind of all these different routes fan out, and they're all kind of different variants of the Camino, you know, but the French Camino is sort of the one that everyone thinks of when they think of the Camino. So same with the Kumano Kodo, there's a bunch of different routes, and the Nakahechi route is the one that kind of most people think of. And that was one of the first ones I walked down there, but I've since walked pretty much all of the old roads down there. And so in total, you know, it's just thousands and thousands and thousands of kilometers of walking that I've done across Japan over the last, really, like, seriously in the last 6 years, but I've been doing it for about 10, 12 years now.
Have you ever considered getting a bicycle?
I've owned 15 bikes over the last 20 years. I love bikes.
Urban biking in Japan is fantastic, isn't it? Like, I love that. But
it's pretty awesome. Yeah.
What about sort of adventure biking? Because it's still slow enough to see places, but it's a bit bigger. You could see more of Japan. Does that ever cross the mind?
Weirdly, no. I mean, I own 4 bikes. Even now, you know, I just love bikes so much. I mean, I don't think there's a vehicle that, or like a tool, an object in the world that like just brings you more stupid, just like fundamental joy getting on a good bike. And I want to try all of them. Every shape of bike I want to ride, you know, you know what I mean? It's like a little, you know, you get a Molten, that's its own sort of weird ride versus like a mountain bike versus like a steel road bike versus like an 80s road bike versus a carbon road. You know, it's like all these different layers. I had a Cadian bike at one point, you know, it's like a fixed gear, blah, blah, you know, all this stuff. It's just fun. I love bikes so much, but I've never thought about doing a mega bike adventure. And I think for me, the reason why it has to be walking is I want to minimize the amount of stuff that can kind of go wrong. Right. So with a bike, you've already added several orders of magnitude more complexity to things. And I want to be forced to contend with everyone I pass. So like, I don't want to be able to put my head down. Like I want to be forced to be moving at a pace where I can't ignore anyone on the road. So I just find with bikes, you can kind of do that a little more easily, but with walking, you have to kind of have to say hello, especially in the countryside where you look like a crazy person. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I love a bike because, well, for many reasons. One of which, though, is good for getting, when you're not in the mood for engaging with the world, you can put your head down and zoom away. When you've got 100 Ethiopian kids throwing stones at you in every village, it's quite nice to be able to zoom past them. But equally, walking is true immersion. No escape, no free wheels downhill. You have little rules to yourself, like you must say hello to every single person in the morning, those sorts of things. Like you're really fully engaged with being, well, cultivating boredom, being radically present, saying hello to people in the morning. Can you tell me a bit about some of your walk rules? Because I like this.
The point is, like, you know, like I enjoy walking, but it's not like I'm fetishizing walking. It's not like walking itself is like the goal. It's just a tool, right? It's just like this kind of platform. It moves you through the world. You set a goal at the end of the day. It feels really good to do it. Like, it's just this kind of catalyst for all these other things to do, layer on top of it. So I find that having rules is helpful for that. And the crux of all the rules is just, it forces you to be in the moment, forces you to be where you are. You can't teleport. That's kind of the word I use when I talk about smartphones, teleporting. They're just teleportation devices. It's like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be on this train. I don't want to be commuting. I don't want to be, you know, putting a podcast in while you're driving is a way of teleporting outside of, you know, away from driving, right? So kind of fast forward things. So the goal is to not fast forward anything and to not teleport. So I don't have any, I'm not allowed to use social media. I'm not allowed to read the news. I find the news is like a really potent kind of teleportation device. I'm not allowed to listen to music or podcasts. I try to pretty much not touch the phone really at all, if I can. And I usually, on the big walks, we can talk more about gear if you want. But like, I found an Apple Watch Ultra is pretty good for loading it up with a map. I use the crazily named app Walk Outdoors, I think it's called, Work Outdoors. It's just a crazy name, but it's a really good, super configurable watch app. And like my watch, I have no notifications on my watch. It doesn't get anything. The only thing it does is it'll get a call. But my phone's always in do not disturb. So it's only VIPs that can get through. So like if my stepdaughter wants to call, or like a close friend or whatever, they can get through to me and then I can just pick it up with the watch. I don't have to touch the phone. And, the Work Outdoors app as a GPS mapping app, and then you're able to load in GPX files and have your route on your watch, which I find is just great. You know, the first couple of years I was walking, I would use my phone, and you're kind of constantly pulling it out and just touching that thing, and it's just nice to not have to do that. And the Apple Watch is beautiful, the beautiful display.
Yeah, good battery life. Yeah. Well, it's interesting you're talking to me about some more high-tech navigation tools than I use on my walks and adventures. I'm more Luddite. So I biked the length of Japan in 2004, 2005, over New Year then. And what I remember there, that was my first time I ever saw satellite navigation. I got in a taxi and the taxi driver plugged it in and it's one of those sort of light, mind-blowing moments. So I actually cycled the length of Japan with just paper maps, which I really loved. And one thing that I loved about Japan was that it was quite familiar to me, and it's a rich country, it's got electricity, you can drink the tap water, all that sort of stuff. So it felt similar to home in that sense. But I've often thought of it as being the most foreign country I've ever been to in many ways, in terms of the culture, the mindset, all this sort of stuff. And you are very, very good at speaking Japanese. You have a very different experience. Whereas when I was in Japan, I loved it because I just had no idea what was going on at any moment. And there's a joy in that. But you have a different sort of appreciation, having it been your home for 20 years and speaking the language very well.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you bring up the GPS sat nav in the cars, because I also remember like in 2003, it would have been, I got in this architect's Range Rover or something. I just remember like all the layers of, like, he also had this chair in his studio that I think cost like $25,000. It was like one of those Le Corbusier, like, you know, leather cow shaped, you know, chairs or whatever. I just remember being really kind of shocked by it all. But I remember distinctly, we were in like Ikebukuro and getting in that car and seeing that nav panel. And, you know, it was just like, oh my God, there was nothing like that in the West.
You know, now you carry that on your wrist for a few hundred dollars, don't you? So it's very much changing that. So when I adventure, I try to do, ideally I'd do zero planning. I'd just walk out my door today with a passport and I'd cycle to South Africa, but I'm not really brave enough to do that. So I have to do a bit of planning to make myself be brave enough to get out the door. And beyond that, I'm very much in the search for spontaneity, randomness, chaos, people inviting me to X, Y, and Z. That's what adventure is about for me. And it's about why. So in Japan, I'd be just wild camping. I'd cycle all day. When the sun goes down, I hide behind some tree and I sleep for the night. That's been always my approach to it. So, whereas your adventures, you very much like to have all your inns and meals planned out in advance. And when I first thought this, I was like, no way, this is the worst idea in the universe. But then you went on to explain why you do that. And then I saw there was actually quite an overlap between what we were striving for. So why do you book all your inns and meals and plan your trip so meticulously in advance?
Yeah, well, I'll get back to that in a sec. But how long was your cycling across Japan? How long did you do that for?
Well, I was cycling around the world for just over 4 years. And I was in Japan for about 3 months.
Non-stop for 4 years?
Yes. So, and in Japan, I cycled out of a Siberian winter to minus 40, crossed into from Sakhalin to northern Japan. It was very cold. I learned the Japanese word for snow on day one, yuki. Cold, very, very freezing. By the time I left Japan down from Nagasaki, it was spring had arrived and it was lovely. So I rode through a sort of season of weather in Japan.
Cool, cool. Did you hit the cherry blossoms or were you a little bit early?
It was a little bit early for that.
Yeah. But for me, for the planning, the idea is that, and I have nothing against just walking out the door and like trying to figure things out. But because the days are pretty long and because a lot of the areas I'm going to are sparsely populated and the infrastructure is pretty sparse, and because I don't want to camp, because I'm doing all these other things too. It's like, there's all these reasons for each of these decisions. My ideal is that everything is booked in advance and all the days are mapped out in advance. So I don't want to think about logistics for one millisecond once I start. That's kind of the goal. And so I just want to get out the door And then that's the last time I'll think about like where I need to be, or if there's going to be dinner, or what I'm going to have to think about for breakfast, or any of that stuff until the end of the walk. So it could be like 30, 40 days later. And I haven't done 4 years of walking or adventuring, but my longest is about 40 days. And the whole point is because I want to be in the moment entirely, and I want to be able to engage with everything as fully as possible without going, oh man, I still haven't figured out where I'm going to stay. And because when I get to the end of the day, I want to make sure I have the time and space to synthesize everything. That's really important to me, to kind of synthesize almost in real time. So all day I'll be walking, talking with people, photographing, kind of taking notes, dictating notes, with the AirPods. You can have one AirPod in, and you can kind of use Siri scripts to sort of append to a note in Apple Notes. And so you can kind of just trigger it and then like kind of record it, transcribes. So I end up recording and transcribing a lot throughout the day. And then I'll arrive at the inn or the hotel or the Minshku, which is kind of like a bed and breakfast. I'll arrive there at ideally 3 or 4 p.m., 5 p.m., 6 p.m. at the latest. And then I'll write, synthesize everything I experienced, thought about, people I talked to, conversations I had. And I'll do a cull of digital photos for the day. Sometimes I'm doing binaural audio recordings in the field. So I'm doing field recordings.
I really like those when you do those.
Yeah, it's really fun. And again, that's like stopping for 5 minutes at like 9:45 in the morning or 10:45 in the morning, just kind of wherever you are, and just stopping, putting the binaural mics out and being quiet for 5 minutes and just recording that. And then I've done some video stuff as well. So I've sometimes done binaural with video. So importing the video, processing the video, cutting it down. Like, again, these aren't like complicated procedures, but like you add them all together, the importing, the bringing into Final Cut, the slicing, the exporting, the uploading to YouTube, the editing all the text for the day, which can be 5,000 words. Getting the photos ready, putting that all together in the form of a newsletter, interspersing the text with the photos, making sure the YouTube links work, and then publishing that every night and doing that every day, day after day after day after day. It's a lot. So
it's
there's
a lot, yeah.
The adventure continues into the brain. It's not just an adventure of body, but this kind of brain adventure at night. Yeah.
Something I find really interesting here is that, I think you and I I've done some long walks as well. I think from our long walks, we're essentially after the same thing. Me, I'm trying to do it through no planning while camping. I also take notes constantly while I'm doing it, but I have a tiny little notebook and a little pencil so that I can write while I'm actually walking. You're doing it, you're Siri-ing the transcription. And so it was kind of doing the same thing, which is about trying to be radically present and fully immersed in the trip, isn't it? But I'm wondering why, and maybe I'm asking this for myself as much as for you, but why do you feel the need to make your walks take a shape, as you describe it, to take a shape through books and photography? Do you ever just think that the walk is enough, that you're just going to go on a walk, take no notes, not tell anyone what you've done, and just have a silent adventure just for you? Or would that be a diminished project?
Yeah, I mean, the giving it a shape it's a nice stroke of luck that people are interested in the things that come out of it. But I'm not
Would you be doing these things if only three people were reading your blogs and newsletters? Would you be doing it anyway?
Well, I'd probably think like, why are only three people interested in this? But you know, I mean, if you look at my numbers, I mean, it's not like, you know, whatever. I'm not Stephen King, you know, and so so a lot of people probably look at the scale I'm operating at and go like, that's the equivalent of three people from a certain perspective,
are you doing it for your audience then more than for you?
No, it's entirely, everything is selfish, and it's entirely to trick myself into it sort of started with tricking myself I was hungry. I was really hungry for guidance and deadlines and a kind of strictness of production. I think my whole life I've struggled in my teens and 20s with real work ethic. I mean, I've managed to accomplish and get a bunch of stuff done, but it always felt like I was operating at a real diminished rate. You know, just it wasn't the, I don't know, just the, I could be doing more. I could always be writing more. There was a kind of laziness or whatever built into life. And for some reason I saw the walk, you know, the first big walk I did that was sort of public-ish was 6 years ago. That was from Tokyo. Well, it was Kamakura to Tokyo, Tokyo to Kyoto. And that I did the SMS project with. So I just, that was just one photo a night that I'd send out with like two sentences. So it was very small, but there was something about doing that which made me, even though it was really tiny, reflect on the day. And then from that, it kind of began to grow more and more and go, oh, okay, this is interesting. And then at the end of that walk, I had a blurb book put together that was only for me. That was kind of a record of the walk, you know, and people could respond. I couldn't see the responses in real time. They're all put in a database. Then I hired this book designer to design it for me so I couldn't see it. And then the book arrived at my house, and that was my first time kind of seeing everyone's responses. There was something about that being turned into an object, even though it was just for me, that I was like, okay, yeah, this really helped me, I think, believe in a certain work ethic that I maybe had wanted to get to and didn't know how to get to. And now I was starting to see it. And so that was really critical. And then just the joy of having some kind of tangible artifact to make real that experience. You know, like when I was working at Flipboard, I had this very short stint of working in a company. It's the only time in my life I ever became an employee of a company. And actually the day I joined, I initially went out as a consultant. And then of course they're like, oh, we want you to join full time. I was like the eighth employee or something. You know, we want to give you equity and blah, 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 all this stuff. You know, the equity ended up being worth zero, but you know, you kind of sign. And I remember the signing that day I signed, it felt like I was dying. It felt like I was signing. I didn't want to know any of the benefits I was getting. It just felt so against, I think, what I had cultivated. I was 30 years old when I did that. And it just felt so against what I had spent my 20s cultivating, this signing into a company. I don't know. There's something pathological about that response to it. But for me, you know, going in there and doing that work was interesting because there was no real tangible output, right? You're making an app. We were making this iPad app. I was working on the iPhone app. And you kind of burn so many thousands, tens of thousands of person hours working on these things. And there's no artifact on the other end. And then like the version gets updated and 3 months later, the APIs are different. So you can't even use an old version of the software. It's, you know, software is very, very weird and tricky like that. So what I did at the end of that stint of working at that company, which I didn't last very long. And I from the beginning, I kind of told everyone I wasn't going to be there for very long. Everyone still got mad at me when I left. It's like, this is the problem is like that people treat, they want companies to be like family, except that they're not really family. And then when you try to leave, it becomes this kind of weird guilt situation because it's like you're leaving a cult. But the thing I did, and I now have great relationships with everyone. I love everyone I've, you know, worked with, blah, blah, blah. It was just this weird, weird moment of like when you say you're going to leave the thing that everyone kind of freaks out. But what I did was I got all of the Git commits that the engineers had put in for the iPhone app. And I got all of our design comps, which were kind of like we had thousands of them sitting in a folder. And I made this like 320 page book or something that was pretty big. It was like 1 foot by 1 foot. And I got one copy printed of that and I presented it to the team on my last day. And I was like, nice. Thank you guys. But yeah, of course, everyone's like, oh my God, we want one. I want one. Like, you know, an investor from Kleiner Perkins was like, make me one. So we ended up making about 4 or 5. It's funny. That is literally the only evidence that any of us had ever done any work at that company. Right.
Gosh. You know, it's, yeah, like, yes.
The app still exists, but not in a form that, you know, in a form that we worked on. So, you know, that's always, for me, books.
Tangible output.
The tangible output is important. How do you take something that's ephemeral, give it shape? And honestly, I think one of the best pieces of technology we've ever invented is the book. It's you know, easily reproducible. You know, it doesn't require batteries. it powers itself. You know, as long as you're not in a humid, wet environment, it's going to be pretty good for a pretty long time.
Yeah. I just read a lovely book about the history of papyrus, which is a very niche topic. But yeah, just thousands of years, this thing has been revolutionizing our lives.
So yeah, so making that book at the end of that first big walk really moved something in my heart. And I think that set me off as like, okay, we need to do more of this. How can we do more of this? Because it just, again, it just gave more purpose for me, selfishly for the walks. And it made me more attentive. It made me work harder. I definitely wouldn't write as much as I do if I didn't have the pop-up walks, if I didn't have the pop-up newsletters or the book as a goal at the end, the very, very end of that chain of action. I would go to sleep. I would get to the inn and I would like watch YouTube for an hour and go to sleep probably. But because I had this kind of purpose or this sort of goal, and because there's the audience serves as kind of a just a check against like my weaker versions of myself, you know, where they, you know, the audience is being there, knowing they're waiting for an email from me. It allows me to kind of just push aside that version of me that wants to be lazy, that doesn't want to do the writing, that doesn't want to do the synthesis. And you know, it's a kind of a win-win because people seem to be into it, but it's really a very selfish activity. There's never a moment where I'm like, oh man, oh God, my subscribers are expecting this. I got to go do this thing. Never for one second have I ever thought that.
Fascinating. Yeah. So I want to move on to talking about it was interesting there. I haven't heard you talk about that, the book you made from your app days. Mm-hmm. I want to move on to talking about your books and particularly your love of beautiful books. But before, just want to ask a couple more things about the adventuring world, beginning with what's your opinion on British sandwiches?
I love them. You read my essay on them, right? Didn't you?
Yes, that was a lovely really nice piece.
Yeah. No, I love them. God, I think that's the perfect walk food, honestly.
What's your favorite British sandwich?
Well, I don't think it's technically a British sandwich because I kind of make a crazy concoction, but I ask for tuna, no mayo, with Branston pickle, and cheddar cheese. I think
Yeah, I don't think that's a British sandwich. I think that is your own concoction. But was that your first encountering of Branston pickle? Is that uniquely British or has that made it around the world?
No, that's just Britain. I love a good pickle cheese sandwich too, but throw some tuna. Let's get some protein going too.
Okay, nice. So the article that I'm mentioning there was you walking the Wainwright route through northern England, through the Lake District, through Yorkshire, very close to where I grew up, by the way. I grew up in the Yorkshire Dales. Yeah. One thing I'm really interested in these days is access to land, access to nature, and whether increasing the access to nature will help get more people out into nature and therefore more connected and caring to the nature and climate crises. So as an outsider coming into Britain, who's experienced life in the US, also in Japan, and walked also in some other countries as well, what was your feeling of the British, or the, sorry, I should in this case I have to say the English, because Scotland's very different, but the English footpath network, the access, how open were the outdoors in England?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, it's amazing. It feels like it should be the baseline for everyone, every country. You know, it's weird.
Did it feel more access than you're used to, say, in Japan or America or other places?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, even in Japan, private property, it's less, you're not going to get shot in the face, but it's more just, you don't, and people I probably wouldn't even, because no Japanese person would think to trespass. If you do trespass, it'll just be seen as quirky, not probably offensive.
Mistake.
Yeah, a mistake or something. So people wouldn't be, I don't think it would be angry, but you just wouldn't want to do it. You'd be kind of taking, almost like taking advantage of Japanese kindness if you do that. But no, that Wainwright walk is a great example of something I did that had no output. It was just me and my friend Peter. And we just walked for 2 weeks. It was great. And that was nice. That was nice to do. But for sure, if I had been writing the whole time, I think I would have had some pretty good essays, and maybe would have had some other. There would have been a depth to it that I think wasn't there, but we just treated it as a, let's just plow through and have fun and just, you know, talk about life and strategize. We were strategizing about this Random House book of mine that's coming out, you know, in a couple of weeks. This is 2 years ago. So it was quite interesting, to have a walk like that. And I think, you know, the difference too, is that when I do my walks, I'm alone. That's really critical. I can't walk with someone and do the writing or the thinking or the photographing. So, just having even one person there changes the entire energy of the experience for me.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I generally, with my adventures, have tried to alternate between doing trips solo and a trip with someone else, because there's lots of pros and cons creatively and internally and all sorts to both. But I've sort of alternated. But let's move on to talking about your books. I think in terms of your books, I came across you first through your book Kissa, which is K-I-S-S-A, Kissa by Kissa, which is about 1,000-kilometer walk. It's Japan. It's about Japan subculture of cafes and sort of quirky pizza toast subculture, which you love in Japan. And out of that came this magnificent beast of a book, which in England costs £75, which is, to my mind, as a slapdash, scruffy sort of guy, it's insanely, obsessively, beautifully nerdy. I think you've given a bit of with your story about the Flipboard and the app, you've given us an idea of what moves you to trying to make books really beautiful sorts of things. But perhaps in terms of your new book now, Things Become Other Things, which is about a 30-day walk through Japan, plus also a decade of your other walking experiences. This book here, did you approach it as an adventurer, as a writer, as a photographer, a designer, or a producer of insanely, obsessively, beautifully nerdy, expensive things? Where does this book fit into those Venn diagrams?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, this book has had so many shapes and has gone through so many metamorphoses. It's just been a crazy project. So it was pretty much exactly 4 years ago, right at this moment, I set off on the walk that led to this book. And that was in the middle of COVID, and it was kind of a weird time. And so I did the newsletter as I was walking. And so I probably wrote, I don't know, what was it, 50,000, 60,000 words or something like that on the road. So it was a lot, it's a lot of writing. Yeah, it would have been something like that. And that writing then formed the basis for what this book became. And I started, working on this book, and one form of the book had a bunch of extra characters. And then this one particular character started kind of popping out more and more, which was my childhood friend, Brian. And I started working with an editor who was like, hey, I think this is who you really want to be writing about. And he helped to guide me kind of in the direction of kind of cutting back a lot of the other people and focusing on Brian and getting to that core story. And sorry, Siri is going a little insane. Hey, Siri, stop.
Siri shouting at you. Does Siri talk at you in Japanese or American?
It talks in an Indian accent for some reason.
Okay. Siri. I presume there is a Japanese Siri.
There is. Yeah, there is. Sorry about that. God, he's stupid. It couldn't be dumber. If you tried to make a dumb thing. And so anyway, Brian kind of took the front row. And then the more I thought about it, there was kind of political undertones to this book. And I thought, okay, this could be an interesting book to bring out to a bigger audience. And like, when you sell a 75 pound book, you're just limiting your audience. Kisa by Kisa, we're right now finishing the sixth printing of it, which is insane, which means we've sold basically 6,000-7,000 copies of that book, which is a lot of expensive books. Like that's wild. You don't sell that many books normally. And so that's great. But obviously, a trade paperback will, or trade hardcover priced at £20 will be a lot easier to sell, even if it's not quite the same level of beauty or refinement.
Yeah. How is your production? Your design, creative, obsessive freak nature. I mean, you send these emails, which I love, like thousands of word emails about the latest iteration of your cover font and stuff. And I'm like, wow, yeah. This guy yeah. operates different to me. So how have you found now moving towards the mainstream thing where presumably you don't have so much obsessive creative control? Are the compromises yeah. and ugly bits? Has it been hard for you to lose a bit of control?
Well, to do a long story short, I pitched to a bunch of people. I got rejected by a bunch of people in New York. And then I was resigned to just doing this book myself. And I was like, okay, great. I'll do another $100, you know, super book. And like 90% of the way through that, Random House reached out to me and was like, hey, we love it. We'd love to buy, you know, da, da, da. And so I ended up striking a contract with them where I maintained fine art rights and they got the trade rights. So it's pretty special. And that allowed me to be as psychotic, obsessive, make this crazy fine art edition that, you know, costs $100 and is full color and beautifully printed and Heidelberg presses and blah, 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 all that stuff. And then for Random House, I doubled the length of the book. I actually kind of reframed the whole thing. So now Brian was a character. Now the whole book is now focused on, it's a letter to Brian, which allowed me to bring back all these other characters. So it really is this incredible sort of rev on it. So I have my fine art edition, which is sort of a minimalist kind of cinematic, Craig Mott cinematic universe fans will be able to process it if you know about me. But it doesn't go back, it doesn't go to my history really at all. It doesn't really give a lot of context. And Random House is like, hey, you know, you're going to have a bigger audience, so you need to give context. And so actually doing that context writing was really powerful in opening up and whatnot. So I kind of, because I'd done my version, and because my version to me represented a kind of perfect design version, right? Like it was, there was no compromise at all. For the Random House edition, I was just like, all right, you know, like, we'll just let them do what they're going to do. And so the printing is not going to be Heidelberg presses, full color, da, da, da. It's not going to be like that. But what it will be is I know the kind of rough paper that hardcovers tend to use, mass market hardcovers. And there is like an interesting quality to that. So I ended up reprocessing all of my photographs and actually adding a bunch more. So there's probably like 30% more photographs in this new edition as well. And it's double the length in text. So it's really a very evolved version in a lot of ways. And and the photos were reprocessed with the knowledge that it's going to be printed on this kind of paper. So yeah. It's black and white, really grainy, kind of cranked the contrast so things would look good printed like this. And I designed the cover basically, so like they sort of let me do that. They resigned to let me
do
that.
That's a rare thing in the mainstream book world, isn't it? So it's it's interesting. They trust you on that.
I didn't want to, but there was a cover designer, jacket designer, Sachi Chandi Damani, who sent over a bunch of great comp, but basically we were kind of like going back and forth, and I was saying, you know, look, I think this photo kind of makes sense. This is something interesting happening here, and then like maybe we could do this with the text, and then they kind of ran. I was kind of art directing it more than designing it. So anyway, so I've got I just got a box of these today. I got like 20 of them, and they feel great. They just
no typo on page one.
Not on page one, but on page like 140 there is one copy miss, which I found out because I did the audiobook. I read the audiobook for this, which is like waterboarding your brain. It's one of the most painful things I've ever done. I don't know if have you ever done.
Yeah, I audio record my own books, and it firstly makes me hate the sound of my own voice. It makes me hate my writing. It makes me want to totally redo the book, and it makes me feel so exhausted that I feel like I've been down the Appalachian coal mines for 12 hours, not just mincing about in a recording studio for two. So yeah, it's quite a brutal experience.
It's so brutal. I mean walking 40k in a day is a cakewalk compared to doing 6 hours of audiobook recording. But yeah, so there's one word that's duplicated by accident on like page 140 or something. We had so many eyeballs on this too. We kind of can't believe that something slipped through.
It's very, I'm not sure you ever get a book without them. I have one friend, Everest climber Paul Deegan, who I would suspect is even more obsessive about life than you are. And he claims that his book is the only book he's ever read without a single typo in it. But yep. seeing as he's yep. also probably the only person who's ever read his book, who knows? I'm really intrigued to read this as a more sort of normal book from you rather than the photo project. So I'm really looking forward to getting my hands on a copy.
But I am, you know, like having sort of just gotten this and looked through, it feels fabulous. And the photography kind of exists with the text in a way that you know, it's sort of more in line. There's a more illustrative element to it. As well as, you know, there's like full
lovely so double pages spread. Yeah. So it's nice. Yeah. British people might know of Robert McFarlane or William Sebald's yeah. books. It's that sort of meditative travel photography.
Very, very Sebaldian. I mean, Rings of Saturn was what I was thinking of as we were doing the design of this.
Well, that was the first book that popped in my head when you showed me that. So I think you're well on those tracks there. So yeah, well, good, I'm very much looking forward to reading it. Your book, you said that this came out originally from a series of walks. You wrote 50,000-60,000 words of newsletter copy during those things, which is a great skeleton for a book. Mm-hmm. You do what you describe as your special projects, which essentially is a membership scheme where people mm-hmm. voluntarily pay.
Not and a then scheme.
I said not scam. It says scheme's not a derogatory word in England. That's fine. That wasn't an insult. Yes. Okay. Don't worry. I'm not calling you a grifter. It's your special project. It's a membership program where people voluntarily pay. You give lots and lots back, but essentially you just do whatever the heck you want and people mm-hmm. enjoy that. And it works symbiotically and mutualistically mm-hmm. really well. I'm so impressed by this and enormously jealous because this is my sort of dream aspiration for my own life. So I think that's where I first came across you actually with your writing about running Kickstarter campaigns and your memberships. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, man, this guy's got it sorted. But what I think would be interesting to share a little bit about for people, not necessarily people who are trying to do their own membership programs, but people who are interested in just the sort of the tug between doing creatively what feels important to you versus also reaching an audience, and you know, which comes first in that chicken and egg, is the rules you have for your membership programs. I really like mm-hmm. your rules. You've got things like clear goals. What's the priority? Is it the goals or the members? And then one really good one about that you say, are there other ways you can earn a living? Seriously, try the other options. Mm-hmm. So what are your other options? So can you tell mm-hmm. me a little bit about the rules you have for your special projects scheme?
Yeah, the scam I run is a membership program where you become a member and get nothing and I get your money. That's how it works. The rules of the membership program are everything is about making books. That's all we're doing. That's the first and foremost, most important goal. Keep that in mind. I run board meetings, so-called board meetings with my members once every 6 months. And it's always the first slide of the board meeting is the goal. It says, number one, we're making books. That's it. That's all this is for. Number two, if any educational stuff happens as a corollary to making the books, along with making the books, great. But everything we're doing is in service to doing better bookmaking. And even the board meetings themselves, it's not about doing that for members. It's about doing it for me to help me plan, help me reflect on the previous 6 months and plan the next 6 months better to make better books. That's really what it boils down to. But it just turns out, it turns out that if you, instead of, you know, I don't know who these people are that can just like do year-end review alone in a room, you know, and like be like, oh yeah, that's what I did last year. Let me do this better. I can't do that. I got to talk to somebody. So it could be a dog, it could be humans, it could be whatever, but there's got to be someone that I'm talking this through. And so the members, it turns out a bunch of them want to listen to me talk through this stuff. And then getting questions from them also helps me reflect on what I've done, what I'm doing, why I'm doing it. Helps solidify reasoning, rationale, and in the end, you know, again, just leads to better book work. You know, getting us, pushing us further down those paths to producing books. And then the archive of all that stuff, slowly but surely over the last 5 years, you know, it's been 6.5 years since I started the membership program, but really 5 since I've been doing anything that has an archive. That's grown into this huge corpus of stuff that if when you join as a member, you get access to it all. And I keep it behind the membership wall, not because I'm like, oh, this is so special, only members should have it, but because by having it be limited in audience, it's easier for me to be vulnerable and honest in a way that, you know, if I'm doing an Instagram reels for 30,000 people, then, you know, I'm not going to be as vulnerable. It's a little more difficult to be honest.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. So the membership program, that's really honestly one of the greatest things is that just by having that paywall, it creates this bounded space where your audience is more limited. And through that limitedness, you're able to be a little more intimate and honest and open. And that way, you know, whatever, if I'm doing a board meeting and I let a slide slip about revenue or whatever, you know, it's like that I didn't mean to show something stupid like that. Like if it's tens of thousands of people, that's pretty stressful. But if it's just a couple hundred, you just go, okay, yeah. And you know, whatever, it's not a big deal. And so it just allows you to be a little more honest about those things and maybe be a little more politically honest as well, where you're not trying to, like, you know, not offend the other side because you're, you know, because you believe in healthcare or something like that, you know, which is like when I really believe in healthcare, you know, and people get freaked out if you say that. It's sort of scary, the big wide open social network spaces. So it becomes a self-selecting group of super fans, people who want to see you succeed, who want to give you the benefit of the doubt. And so that honesty is kind of embraced by that sort of audience. So
that's,
and it helps,
interesting,
you know,
aspects.
And it just helps me be more honest with myself about why I'm doing what I'm doing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting aspect of, I'd never considered that aspect of it before. So another part of your projects, your membership things, there's the, you know, I've spent quite far too much time trying to have like a million fans and then realizing that actually only 50 people really care about riding bicycles and sleeping in tents. So trying to learn what is the natural size of my interest pool. And the classic Kevin Kelly essay of 1,000 true fans has really become my guiding principle of how can I make what I do a viable lifestyle, a business, really. But what something really interested me is that you're considering capping the number of your members. Now, this is a problem I definitely do not face myself, but why on earth would you cap the limit of your members? This is really intriguing.
Yeah, well, you know, this is, again, to maintain that intimacy. And look, I'm not at a place where I feel like, oh yeah, and it's time to cap it. But I do think that if you cap it, and then you have essentially a waiting list for people who want to join but can't join, and then it would just be like a first in, first out sort of situation. One of the things about membership programs is like you're constantly dealing with churn, right? So it's like total number of members over the last 6 years is way, way, way higher than current active members, and so, you know, that's just part and parcel of these things. And I think if you had a cap and you said, look, we're full and I'm not going to let more people in than this, when that membership is going to expire, it makes people think twice about, do I want to give up my spot? You know? And I think there's something really powerful and interesting about that. And also it just feels a little like punk rock to be like, no, I don't, not only do I not want, you know, a million people subscribing to this stuff, like I'm not going to let a million people subscribe to it. So
yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
Nice. I like
But I like the idea of, I want to join, I can't join, I'm on the waiting list. And then when someone's about to like renew, they have to go, oh man, but if I give this up, I can't join again. And then I lose my spot. And then, you know, da da da. Like it just creates a kind of interesting scarcity that I think you don't feel online that much. And it's kind of cool. I think NFTs tried to do this. This was kind of part of the allure of NFTs, you know, back 10 million years ago in 2020. when everyone was buying, you know, monkey, racist monkey JPEGs and stuff like that. And part of that was a false, like a false scarcity. But I think you could do it in a way that doesn't feel disgusting and has more meaning than a random JPEG, you know?
Yes. Yeah. So I mentioned that Kevin Kelly and his essay, 1,000 True Fans, bang on about this approximately once a week. So any listeners who hasn't read that and is trying to be in some sort of way creatively self-employed and not go totally insane and constantly compare themselves to people way more seemingly successful, you should read 1,000 True Fans.
Yeah.
But that leads me on to talking about the walk and talk things that you do. A year or so ago, suddenly all these people who I find fascinating online all started talking about, hey, we've been on this walk. Jason Kotke, whose blog is the only blog I'm still reading after 20 years, and other cool people. So you mentioned earlier that you really like to go on walks by yourself and you get a lot out of it by yourself and creatively and things. So, but you also now organize these walk and talks where you and a few of your friends go off and walk somewhere and talk about stuff. So what do you do? Why are they great? And should we all in our own little groups go and do these things with our own friends?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of times it's not friends. It's people we've never met. So Kevin Kelly and I started running these about, I guess, 2017, 2018, somewhere around there. We kind of went on the first one 2016, but it was only three of us. And it was sort of a prototype that then led us to go, oh, this is really cool. We should do more of these. We should do these at like a bigger scale. And then we started. We had a couple where basically it's 8 to 10 people. 8 is the ideal number, we've kind of realized now. We invite 6 people, 7 people, 8 people on a walk with us, plus us, the two of us. And then we usually the ideal is 6 days of walking, 7 nights of dinners. And every night we do a 3-hour Jeffersonian dinner, which is one topic, one conversation around one table. And so we have to. It can be logistically kind of annoying sometimes, depending on which country we're in, where we're doing the walk. But you know, you get a table, ideally a quiet-ish environment. So England is actually the hardest place for us to do these, because it's all pubs and it's impossible to find a quiet space in a pub. And when you have to listen to people across the table, it's really, really difficult. Really
shouting
difficult.
About soccer and stuff.
Yeah,
and Brexit.
Yeah. So England, it's funny. It's the best. It's probably the most easy place to do the walks. It's the hardest place to do the talking. So, but even though we've done Cotswolds twice. And like I said at the beginning of this, like a lot of the people we invite, we don't know. We just know of their work and we perceive them to be hopefully not a narcissist and kind of interesting and potentially up for adventure. And we kind of really bang on it when we invite people. We send out these invitations to folks and, you know, we really say like, look, you have to be ready for an adventure. Like you have to be really willing to roll with punches, you know, and the cost of these things is not a lot. We just did Spain a month ago, which was amazing. That was really wonderful. I think the Camino de Santiago, the French way is probably one of the best places to do this. So if you want to organize a walk and talk and you want luggage forwarding, so, you know, you can invite people of all ages and it doesn't require, you know, intense physical capabilities. So you don't have to be carrying a week's worth of stuff on your back. So you want luggage forwarding, which the Camino has. You want lodging every night just to like kind of simplify things. We did one in Bali a year ago that we were all sleeping on a bamboo platform in the jungle every night, which was, that was intense. And I mean, that group bonded really, really well. But I don't think we'll ever do another one of those. It's just you need your own room. You want to be able to close a door. You want to, you know, you just want that space.
So you walk all day, chitter chattering about all the little groups and micro groups, talking about the weather, everything. But then
you bounce between everyone. Yeah,
and that's all kind of lovely and I guess normal for anyone going for a walk with their friends. But the different point, the USP, I suppose, of this concept is the evening you gather around a table and force everyone to discuss one topic. What sort of topics are they? Who chooses the topics? How does it work?
What's a USP? Is that ultra special point?
A unique selling point.
Ah, unique selling point. Right.
That's my one business acronym. Oh, I feel like Jeff Bezos yeah. now.
There you go. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We found good product market fit. And no, the dinners are really they're key, because that's where the bonding happens, because you really listen to everyone. Everyone speaks, and you do this 7 nights in a row. So you're getting 20 plus hours of really active engagement with a bunch of adults, many of them you never have met before. And many of the people we invite have no idea who the other people are. You know, we just had, normally, you know, we're not like hush hush about it, but you know, we try to keep things private. There's no social media allowed during the walks for the most part. We tend to not talk about or post photos of people that have been on the walks, but like, on the last walk, I don't think these guys would be, I'm mad that I doxed them, but like, what's really fun is putting together different folks that you wouldn't expect. So like,
lovely.
David Eagleman was on this last walk, who is this incredible neuroscientist who is probably going to win the Nobel Prize. I mean, he's just this freakishly pulsing brain of a human, but also just so kind and just zero narcissism, zero ego, like just really wonderful, wonderful guy, but like deep, deep scientist guy. And then we had this character actor, this amazing, brilliant character actor who has been in Hollywood for the last 35, 40 years. He's been in 190 movies and TV shows, like, you know, sort of inhabiting a very different place in his body and mind. And so to be able to have like guys like that across the table from each other is a lot of fun. And so, you know, we'll talk about things like on this last walk, one of the topics was, are humans inherently good or evil? You know, it's like,
wow, fantastic. It's fascinating. So this feels to me like it reminds me of like a gathering in Britain called the Do Lectures, which is a series of people doing talks, kind of like TED Talks. The organizers, David and Claire Hyatt, they really carefully gather together the people who come to it in order to fuel all these interesting conversations beyond the speaking stage. And by the way, you should contact them. They would love to have you as a speaker. Like, nerdy design, adventure, computery stuff, boom, perfect for the Do Lectures. And anyone listening to this, if you haven't seen the Do Lectures, check out some of their lectures online. They're really cool.
I'm way ahead of you, man. I did Do in 2010.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh wow. Gosh. Back in the day. Okay. So I'm guessing that is, yes. Okay. Sorry. You're way ahead of me, but yeah.
David is wonderful. I love him. I love everything they do is pretty magic.
Yeah.
But yeah. So like we had, you know, one of the talks was like, you know, it can be broad like that, or it can be more focused. Like, how do you use money? Like, just talking about money in general and just, you know, kind of going around the table and really, what's your philosophies about money? How do you think about money? Like, how do you think about, you know, there's a lot of parents sometimes, you know, at these walks, and like, so, you know, the gamut of like successful but not wealthy to literally the second wealthiest person in the world, you know, Jeff Bezos joined one of the walks. You know, that's the gamut of people that can be on these things. This is before Jeff turned a little, you know, icky with all of his wall, you know, going all this, doing all this political crap. This is before that. It was right before all that started. So I don't
going on a walk is a wonderful leveler, isn't it? Everyone gets sore feet. Everyone gets hot and sweaty. Everyone's hungry. So it's a lovely leveler and an icebreaker. So I think this is a great thing for people to set up with their own little groups.
It's amazing. Yeah. And in fact, the walk and talks, we've enjoyed them so much, and we've done so many of them now, that we wrote up, you know, everything we know about walk and talks. Kevin and I wrote up this huge document,
which is brilliant.
It gives you the full blueprint.
Yeah.
Anyone can emulate this. The hardest part is finding, like six or seven people that can take a week off. That's honestly the most difficult thing. And a lot of it's having really understanding partners who allow the one half of the relationship to leave for a week.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is an enormous, enormous, often neglected aspect of being lucky enough to go off and do adventures. You mentioned in your road in your newsletter once that sometimes the only way adventures can be had is to shove them in against the tide of life. Mm-hmm. So trying to fit adventure in is a hard, hard thing. I'm conscious of time, so I want to ask you about just one final small little topic, which is close to my heart in terms of my current obsession with nature disconnection, with society becoming disconnected from nature. Mm-hmm. And I believe that having huge spin-off effects, why basically no one cares that the planet's burning and no one's doing anything about it. So the more we can connect with nature, that we start to care, we start to feel responsibility. That's my sort of big thing that I'm obsessed with these days. So it made me really interested to read your recent piece about litter in Japan, because Britain's covered in litter. It's a horrible amount of litter in Britain. And I'm really interested to get your thought from Japan about what litter says about societies and individuals and our sense of responsibility and connection to place.
That's funny. I mean, I don't have an image of England as being very littered.
Good. Well, I guess you've been to the Cotswolds and the Wainwright Way, so that's good to hear.
Well, even London doesn't feel, you know, like Paris I went to a couple of years ago and I was like, what the F is going on here? It was so dirty.
I love Paris, but it does smell of wee.
Yeah, wee and just garbage everywhere. And it was just crazy. I was like, what is this? It was like going into a war zone or something. But no, London to me feels, London feels really clean and whatnot.
Well, tell me then about litter in Japan.
But this is a good example of like what, like, so, okay. So if you came, you know, you should join us on a walk and talk sometime, like, and you come on a walk and talk and, one of the topics should be like exactly like this. Why aren't more people caring about climate change? Like that could be the topic for the night or like, you know, we'd kind of workshop it a little, we do a little workshopping. Kevin's really good at kind of teasing out a more, because people tend to get sometimes be overly specific. So Kevin would kind of tease maybe at it a little bit and be like, you know, what, you know, why aren't we more aware of climate change? Why isn't the average person paying more attention? Or like, maybe like, are we overreacting? Like, is it actually better than we think? Like, are we going to be okay? Like the narrative is that we aren't going to be okay, but actually, is it going to be fine? If you look at the real numbers, you know, so anyway, we, for 3 hours, you could kind of go into all this stuff and there'd be probably someone at the table that was, like we had Saul Griffith, on one of the walks, and he's one of the biggest climate change, electrification proponents. So moving everything to electricity, so electric everything, and then, creating clean energy to power all the electric things. He's this incredible Australian guy. So again, just so freakishly smart. And he's done a TED talk about exactly like the slope of electrification and all that stuff. And you talk to Saul and it's really funny. It's because, you know, these people who are kind of right at the edge of science and technology, tend to have this sort of view, or they can kind of see maybe 5 to 10 years further down than the average person can see. And Saul is pretty optimistic. You know, this is like 2.5 years ago when we were talking, and he was, you know, pretty, and I think actually there's some numbers that just popped up today about in the US where I think 50% of energy being produced now is clean, something like that. So it's not fossil fuel related energy production. Then solar, the cost of solar.
Britain, yeah, who's the godfather of the Industrial Revolution and coal, we've gone green essentially. So yeah, there's definitely a case for that. There's a good podcast I like called Outrage and Optimism, which is three climate experts talking about different topics. And that's quite good for getting outrage, but also having some optimism and hope. But yeah, tell me that. I love your story about trying to leave litter in Japan. So go into a cafe and give some guy your trash, something like that. The Japanese attitude to litter is important for British people to learn.
Yes. So I love you're such a good keeper on tracker. It's good. But I just want to use that as an example, because that's a great example of a walk and talk sort of dinner conversation. And you can just kind of go on and on and on about it. Like, what could we do? Okay, what were three things that we could all do to make people more aware? And then talking about garbage in Japan could be one of the things, like, why doesn't Japan have garbage issues? And it really is. It's just this cultural phenomena where anything that you produce that's garbage is your responsibility. There aren't public trash cans throughout Tokyo. There is no culture of like, oh, I've got something to throw away, let me like tuck into this shop and throw it in their garbage. It's funny because it's like you're carrying a Snickers bar and you're fine. Okay, yeah, I got my Snickers bar, da da da, I'm doing a walk, I'm in a park, blah blah blah. I eat my Snickers bar, and then suddenly like the wrapper is toxic waste. You're like, I can't have this, I don't want this in my pocket, oh my god. But it's like it weighs less than it did before. It's, you know, it was the exact same thing you had 3 minutes before you ate the Snickers. Why is that suddenly such a toxic asset for us? And then you start searching for the garbage can. On some of these walk and talks in Japan, we've had, you know, Americans and British people, whatever, and like people will, you know, we'll be in the middle of nowhere and we'll have like a lunch box that we're carrying, you know, like with onigiri, rice balls and stuff for lunch, and we'll eat lunch in the middle of nowhere in a forest, and then they will just obsess for the next 2 hours about finding anywhere to throw that thing away. And I just, this mentality of once something becomes quote unquote garbage, has to be thrown away, and it's not my responsibility to hold this thing, is a weirdly Western concept. And over here in Japan, it's like, if you produce trash, that's your responsibility. It's like, if you go to the park, you know, it was cherry blossom season a couple weeks ago, you know, the parks were full of people. You go to the park the night after the cherry blossom parties are all done, there's no garbage left in the park. Now, in the bigger parks, they do have garbage cans for these seasons because it is just like such a massive stuff. But, you know, you go to Valencia Park in San Francisco on any Sunday at like 6 p.m. and it's like just covered in trash. It's like everyone just leaves everything out there.
I love the Japanese soccer fans at the World Cup cleaning up the stadium afterwards. It's wonderful. Am I right in thinking that Japanese elementary schools, primary schools, don't have cleaning staff and that the kids do the cleaning? Am I right in thinking that?
The kids, well, I think there is cleaning staff too, but the kids do a bunch of cleaning as well, yeah.
Which is an amazing, well, I mean, that's how you get it started, isn't it? You teach the kids not to do it and on it goes from there.
Yeah, well, and it goes, you know, it keeps fanning out. Like if you own a home, you're expected to clean in front of the home. Like you're supposed to keep that clean. If you own a shop, you're going to sweep the leaves. You're going to sweep up any garbage in front of your shop. You're going to take care of that. So there is this kind of assumed social responsibility of your general space if it touches the public eye. And people don't even think twice about whether or not they should do it. It's just, that's obviously what you do. It's why you put pants on in the morning. Like if you're a cisgendered male identifying person, you know, and you go out in the world and you normally wear jeans, it's like you don't just go out in underwear for the most part. You put your jeans on too. And it's like, you don't even think about, okay, I know it's time to put on jeans. Oh my God, I got to put on jeans. This is such a burden to put on jeans. That's kind of how I think Japan feels about, so responsibility, self-responsibility for garbage and your kind of public facing spaces in the world.
Thank you for that. Cause I thought that article was really interesting. Just the blindingly obvious fact that you've got a Snickers bar, you carry it around all day, and then you eat the Snickers and suddenly you're desperate to get rid of the plastic. The way you articulated that, I thought was really good. So thank you for that. But I'm well aware that you have not stayed up late. Oh, also, you're very, very much making me nostalgic for Japan. It's one of my very favorite countries for traveling. I would urge anyone to visit. Wonderful, wonderful place. But you haven't stayed up late at night in Japan to talk to me about underpants and and trash cans. You're here essentially to flog your book. So my final thing as we wrap up would be to, what would you like the listeners to do in terms of signing up for your newsletters, buying your books, joining special projects? What's your little plug at the end?
Yeah, do it all. Just, you know, you throw all your money at me. That's the best way to do it.
Tell us about this new book then.
Yeah, the Things Become Other Things, the Random House Edition, which you can buy on any, if your listeners are in America, any local bookstore will have it. Your libraries will have it. Amazon obviously has it. I think all throughout Europe, Amazon's carrying it. Definitely the Kindle edition, audiobook edition should be available wherever you are in most countries. And I think even the physical edition, depending on the tariff situation, who knows? It could be no book, 12 billion% tariff on books. Who knows? But I would say that book, if you're listening to this and you've never heard of me before, if you've never read any of my work before, I think it's an interesting introduction because it gives you a ton of context about who I am. It talks about how I came to Japan when I was 19, what I experienced and felt when I was here. And then it goes into the philosophy of my walks. So like why I walk, what I get out of it. And I had this kind of walking mentor, this guy named John, who he's also introduced in the book. And we talk a lot about how John sees the world and how that's influenced how I see the world. So I think that's a great place to start. But also go to my website, craigmaude.com, and you can sign up for my newsletters are free. The membership program, Special Projects, the main benefit you get from it is discounts. So if you want to buy Kisa by Kisa, which is $100, you can get $40 off if you become a member. If you want to buy the fine art edition of Things Become Other Things, you can get a discount on that. If you want to buy, I have some photographic prints that are for sale, fine art photographic signed prints, you get discounts on those too. So that's kind of, I'd say, the way to approach it. But Things Become Other Things, the Random House edition, is a book I am just so proud of. It's a beautiful object, even though it is mass market. I think the photographs came out so well in this edition. The editing, the version of the book we got to, I'm just so, so proud of. And I'm so excited to have this out in the world. So I'd say start there, and then you can work your way into the other stuff.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, yeah. Craig. I hope your book does fantastically well. I always enjoy it when your newsletters land in my inbox. And I particularly enjoy when you go off on your walk and you do these funky pop-up newsletters, which are for the duration of your walk, and then the list is deleted. So I'd urge people to sign up for those as well. But keep doing what you do. You've been a real inspiration to me over the years, and I'm really delighted to have had the chance to chat to you. So thanks very much, Craig, and good luck with flogging the book.
Thank you.